Sir Alexander Glenriegel II.
Taking into consideration the length of negotiation between the Germans and Prince Paul and the Barbarossa timetable, it seems to me that Prince Paul managed to haggle onwards for a surprisingly long time. This, I think, is supported by what both Peter Garron, who was second secretary and was very close to Prince Paul, and I suspect Prince Paul confided in him that more than we knew. Again, I think this is just repeating that historically, I think history has been a little hard on Prince Paul.
I think there was something that you wanted to add about the children of the royal family, because I raised the fact that I had interviewed earlier Robin Duff, who had tutored them at some time.
Yes, it was merely to say that what might be helpful there, later in London, Squadron Leader Dunlop Mackenzie, Archie Dunlop Mackenzie, was appointed to Prince Paul. He and I were together in the Arctic previously. He's an old friend living in Edinburgh now. And you might find a point of linkage on King Peter through him. He's not very well, but it would be a pity if his experiences were not recorded. He's a very wise, quiet chap, and that's really why I mentioned that.
Can you give some more details about the impressions you got of the Agrarian Party?
Oh, yes, sure. The leader, Milan Gavrilovic, earlier, Tupanin was our leader. Milan Gavrilovic was appointed Yugoslav minister to Moscow, so he handed over leadership to his deputy, Tupanin. They represented the well-to-do peasantry of Serbia. Peasantry, perhaps misleading, prosperous farmers who'd owned their own land. Serbia's rulers had no aristocracy. They were killed off at Kosovo, no titles. And the peasant party, independent lot, very definite, very loyal, and they and the women folk, their family, are very, very crucial to understanding the rights and wrongs of Chetnik partisan dispute later on in Serbia.
What in Russia would be called kulaks?
There's no counterpart because of the absence of an aristocracy, and it's a difference too between Croatia and Serbia, where the big landowning families in Croatia were, of course, stemmed directly, culturally, if you like, from the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and where socially, yes, there was a divide. Serbia, that divide, or was a divide between city and country, if you like, but Serbia is peculiarly united people in that way. Obviously, there are poorer peasants and richer peasants. But the Agrarian Party represented, I would say, the heartland of Serbia. Pretty effective, pretty real and everyday life in the villages, but, of course, in numbers, relative to the whole of Yugoslavia, not so great, not so enormous. But something very, very special to that country. And wholehearted support. I mean, we would meet together almost every day. I mean, it was as close contact as that.
Under what circumstances and where?
in their headquarters in Belgrade. And I used to go with them to village occasions, marriages, christenings. You had to be prepared for 24-hour drinking, you know, pretty... they're quite formidable occasions.
And you
adequate answer, is that all right?
You didn't have any personal contact with Croatian leaders.
No, I didn't. Now, that was handled from Zagreb, as I said earlier, largely by Stephen Clissold, and by our consul general, whose name just has escaped me for a moment, who was a very competent performer. But it was different. I think Vacek's Croatian peasant party probably contained fewer potential Ustaki elements. But this is where the two cultures really departed, in that your Serbian peasant no way was anything but a British alliance real to him. Nothing else, I mean, could he contemplate. Croatia, understandably, Vienna, Budapest had been the centres for centuries, so the culture was different.
How much did the Serbians at that time look to the Soviet Union?
I think one's got to be very accurate about this answer, that Mother Russia, in its old context of Slav brotherhood, Slav affinity, yes, emotionally, very much. I think the murder of the Tsar, if they remembered it, element of shock, and the revolution, certainly to the sort of independent peasant landowner, with, you mentioned the Kulak, and the Ukrainian history, I think this again, it was a Russia which was rather different from the mother Russia that emotionally they knew. There's a Montenegrin, the wonderful Montenegrin song of World War I, which runs something like this: the east wind blows from the Carpathians, and we, and the Russians, are 100 million strong, what 800,000 strong. I think that exemplifies it quite well. Emotional, yes. If you compare, for example, Serbia and Bulgaria, and the Bulgars, definitely, liberation came from the Russians, Shipka Pass, the war memorials and the villages look northeast. It's quite interesting that virtually every war memorial looks northeastwards. I think that Russia, whether Tsarist or Bolshevik Russia, that affinity remained very, very close indeed in Bulgaria. It's more complex. It was more complex than in Serbia. It was weaker.
At that time, in the spring of 1941, did anybody express any socialistic or communistic sympathies to you? You mentioned the Belgrade University, but did anybody express Marxist sympathies to you personally?
Yes, certainly. And predictably, the children of welfare families of exactly as you might expect of the late 1930s, a considerable number of younger people. And one did know too that through police operations in Belgrade, that older communists were regarded as a great threat to the state, and certainly the Serbian police did not use kid gloves in the treatment of them. But of course, they did again this thing of, as Tito and Gilas have written so clearly, that they were all put in prison together, and really the University of the Prisons was churning away, and its first class and second class and third class honours students were being turned out very suitably at the expense of the state. So the element was very visible, and fear of communism conflicting again, you see, with Mother Russia. So you had an emotional mental dilemma within many people.
But when you went into the villages, do you think any of those peasants or rural people who might later have joined the partisans would have been communist sympathizers?
I honestly couldn't give you a reliable answer to that. I just couldn't, because several reasons, because I don't know, firstly. Also, Serbian enjoyment of any occasion is such that to hell with tomorrow, you know. Today we're going to get on with today and enjoy today. So I couldn't give you a convincing answer to that.
Had you at that time in the spring of 1941 heard of Tito?
Nope.
Did you get to know at all, or how well did you get to know Draža Mihailović?
Quite well. I mentioned earlier Colonel Clark's close relationship with the DMI, Colonel Popovich. And it was Popovich who said, I would like you to meet a colleague of mine, Colonel Mihailović. And he gave the reasons. I think our first meeting was in the General Staff, and quite a long one, of probably an hour or two. Then Junior Namery and I, this quite early, asked him to dinner one night. He dined with us in our small flat in Belgrade, and we spoke mostly French. His English was quite good, but his French was better. And then, after Julian departed, I probably met him certainly three or four times, again, at home, always. Impression of a quiet, studious, academic man, unhurried, excellent listener, and well-informed. I do remember very well this, on world affairs. He was quiet, but whenever he spoke, it was measured and considered. I developed a feeling of great respect and affection for him. There's quite an understatement way. It's not easy to find the right word for it. I felt a deep sincerity, if you like. No hyperbole or anything of that kind. A little exaggeration. And I can only say I'm extremely proud to have known him.
Did you gather at that stage in spring 1941 what his attitude towards the Axis powers might have been?
Oh, totally hostile. Because the whole basis of conversation was the Germans will attack, resistance will be short, and we are discussing post occupation resistance, taken for granted.
Did he seem to be much of a potential leader?
Well, remember, I was '39, 26, 27, 28 probably then. I'd had Arctic experience. Leadership's something always interested me very, very much. Different qualities of leadership, of quieter types and more flamboyant types, if you like. He did not leave the impression that he was a natural leader, no. He left, if there was an impression that this was a competent manager, staff, no, a competent staff officer, thorough, cautious, certainly deeply aware, but we all were, of Serbia's losses in World War One and the desperate effect of perhaps 500,000 or a million losses in a war which was to come. Very conscious of that. We did not anticipate, as far as I can remember, ever the sort of tactics or strategy which would be employed. I don't think we ever touched on it. And it probably would have been, guessing aloud had we done so. But the impression of a man of total integrity, of honour, I wouldn't say of limited capacity, not at all. I think he had considerable capacity. But of leadership, no. I don't think so.
In the early part of 1941, I believe that it was the scheme of the British authorities to try to construct in the Balkans some kind of entente or alliance which would be an ally of Britain in the desperate situation we faced then in the war with Germany. Did you have any opinion at that time as to what the attitude of the Serbs might be towards some kind of alliance involving both them, Britain, the Turks, the Greeks, and maybe other elements there?
Yes, indeed. You rightly say that was the strategic hope or purpose. And with Turkey, I think considerable effort was put into that, both by the Yugoslavs themselves and by the British. And of course, after the Italian attack on Greece and the early Greek successes in Albania, I myself attended two or three staff conferences with, I think, General Hayward in Athens in 1940-41, because we were also working on the possibility of fomenting Albanian risings through Junon Emre, again initiated that through Ganibeg in northern Albania and through the Mati and Mediti tribes. Yes, indeed. I mean, that was part, an ongoing part, if you like, of purpose following the Italian attack on Albania. In regard to Romania, I don't think any hope, the feeling that Germany had already established, well, at least potential control of Romania. And Bulgaria, there was, we were working with the, again, the Agrarian Party in Bulgaria under George Dimitrov, not GM Dimitrov, sorry, not George, not Georgi Dimitrov, GM Dimitrov, which came to naught there was spoken of an attempt to have Boris of King Boris killed. It was a little bit of a boy's own paper effort. I remember there was a chap who used to come along to claim his monthly cheque for this, but circumstances were always not propitious, and it was bad luck, and he collected his cheque, but and several cheques, but I think that bit is probably best forgotten. But coming back to your question, yes, indeed, and but of course it never came off.
But did traditional animosities play any part in prejudicing the Serbs against, say, the Turks?
Not at all, no, no. Turkish, it's an interesting, I think the typical Serb family, having been under Turkish occupation for 400 or 500 years from Kosovo, I think they retained a rather healthy respect for the Turks, fighting qualities, tough people, not sissies, you know. We bashed the Turks, but by God, we admire them. Now, I wouldn't say any opposition of that type.
So people they would like to be on the side of?
Oh, yes, yeah, definitely.
Now, you were just about to move off when I interrupted you in the narrative from Yugoslavia. Can you tell me what happened to you next?
Yes, quite simply. The next 8 or 10 weeks, really without significance, the Italians moved us first. Well, they moved us first to Tirana, flew us in Savoia Marchetti's bombers to Foggia, having got a laissez-passe for these flights from Allied command. I suspect that they moved absolutely everyone who had to be moved during that 10 days, because the air was full of aircraft carrying people. And we landed Foggia when the Africa Corps were going through. I had a nice little. I met old tatty RNBR uniform, met, I think, three or four German officers, and they said, "You're not Italian, are you?" And I said, "No, I wasn't." And they said, "What are you?" And I said, "I was British." "Oh," they said, "that's, thank God for that. Good to talk to you chaps instead of the Italians." And they were en route for, of course, North Africa. The Ju-52s were coming in like that. I mean, the move was on hard. Then Chianciano in Tuscany, and I'm told that Ciano had already decided Italy was not going to win the war. And we represented a small group of pawns, call it. Why hand them over to the Germans, send them out, gives me a good mark, you know. I think it was as simple as that, to Madrid. And then...
Excuse me, did the Africa Corps, what kind of impression did they create on you?
As bloody good. They looked as formidable as a Wehrmacht looked at that time. I know, very formidable.
Sorry, I interrupted you
not
talking about Madrid.
Yes, no, that was a memory. I mean, you sparked back a very vivid impression on Foggia Airport of these guys are not they're not going to be easy to beat, you know?
With armour?
Not bearing everything. And, of course, morale absolutely top at that moment, you know? So, back to UK. In August, I think, to be told by DNI that I was going to be shot back to Spitsbergen, where we were going to evacuate the Norwegian and the Russian coal miners. So, should we make that next part?
Please, if
okay.
You could go into the details of that.
Spitsbergen had had mining population in the Norwegian mines of about 800, Russian mines are probably about 1,100 for several years back. Soviet government requested us to evacuate their people to Murmansk, and the Norwegian government rather unwillingly asked if that was being done, if their own people could be brought back to the UK. Force was established of Empress of Canada, I think, Czech name, and one of the empresses anyway, one other passenger ship under the command of Admiral Vian in, I think, Nigeria, certainly two destroyer escort. And we went in to Barentsburg, firstly, the Russian mine, and then Longyearbyen. German meteorological flights were being flown occasionally from North Norway at that time. And the Norwegian, we in fact simply continued the normal daily Norwegian meteorological pattern back to occupied Norway. And we had no interference for 6 days. We reported continuing bad weather, no cloud, heavy snow flurries, that sort of thing. And no flights were made, and it's quite remarkable. Empress of Canada removed the Russians, took them back to Murmansk, and then we evacuated the Norwegians. And it is that moment that future train of events begins. The manager of the Norwegian mine was Einar Sverdrup, member of very distinguished Norwegian family from the Lofotens. His grandfather had been Nansen's captain in Fram, Captain Otto Sverdrup. They're a very determined family. They look it, and they are. His two brothers, just to give you the quality, Jack Sverdrup lived in America. He became a major general in the U.S. Army, and he built the airfields in the Pacific Islands as they went eastwards again. And Harald, his second brother, was director of the Woodhull Oceanographical Institute in America, became American vice admiral, so not a bad record. Einar was obstinate as could be. We were fortunately friends already. And he said, this is bloody scandalous, evacuating this place. I understand the miners going, but, and he produced a letter from his brother Jack, written from America. I wish I had kept a copy of it. But Jack said,